Hundreds of thousands of people have filed unemployment claims here in Wisconsin. The State Department of Workforce Development saw a record high of those claims earlier during this pandemic, and not everyone who's applied and been approved for unemployment benefits has gotten payments. That means some people can't make ends meet, and they're in jeopardy of losing their homes. It's The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about evictions in Wisconsin here on the Ideas Network, and you're part of this conversation. So we're wondering, are you worried about losing your home right now? How have you figured out how to work with a landlord to make sure that you don't have to leave your apartment or your house? What questions do you have about your rights? 800-642-1234. There's a line for you at that number, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Rafael Ramos is an attorney with Legal Action of Wisconsin, where he serves as the coordinator for Legal Action's Eviction Defense Project. He joins us now to talk about evictions. Rafael, thanks for taking the time to talk with us today.
Good morning. It's my pleasure to be on. Thank you for having me.
How has this pandemic affected renters' ability to keep up financially?
Well, I think, the answer is not going to be surprising. It's made it harder for people to make rent. You know, I think the thing that coronavirus has done, maybe more than anything else, is really kind of illustrated how many people in the country really live on the razor's edge of poverty. And what it's done is it's moved the line a little bit farther, so that people who were once safe and relatively stable are now facing the risk of eviction and unemployment in ways that they haven't before. So I think, you know, as people lose jobs or are furloughed because of COVID-19, they find it harder to do things that they were able to do in the past. And that's adding to a group of people who previously were at risk of those sorts of things. So I think it's made it much harder for people economically, just because the resources that they used to use to make payments just is not there.
Sure. So that steady paycheck came in and then went out to expenses. And now that it's not coming in, there's no source so that you can pay those bills. And you wind up having to choose, right, what you pay?
Exactly. And people have to prioritize. I mean, one of the things that's kind of been a constant theme for us when talking about housing is the affordability of the housing and what people need to pay for housing in order to pay for everything else in their life. You know, the idea that 30% of your income should go to housing is making that affordable has been a consistent theme even before the coronavirus. But now with income and resources being reduced, people have to make a choice. Are you going to pay your rent? Are you going to buy groceries for your family? And it's a difficult position for anyone to be in.
Wisconsin had an eviction moratorium during this pandemic. It ended on May 26th. What's happened to the status of renters then who are facing evictions after this date? What's changed now?
So it's a great question, and it's a little complicated. So the eviction moratorium that went into place, it did, as you said, end on May 26th. And what the moratorium did was put a prohibition on landlords to stop them from filing eviction actions in court, as well as prohibit them from giving notices terminating tenancies, for example, for failure to pay rent during that moratorium. And as far as the eviction process is concerned, the notice is the first step in the eviction process. So the ban basically stopped prohibited landlords from taking that first step because of the issues caused by coronavirus. So now what tenants are seeing is are now in the position where those notices are starting to come through. And as soon as those notices expire, that's when tenants can unfortunately expect to see the eviction case actually filed in court to start the eviction process to have somebody removed from their home.
Rafael Ramos is an attorney with Legal Action of Wisconsin. He's the coordinator for the Eviction Defense Project. And we're taking your calls if you have questions about the evictions process in Wisconsin. 800-642-1234. Maybe you're a renter, perhaps you're a landlord. What do you want people to know, or what question do you have about the legal process as you figure out what happens in your life? 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. So, Rafael, you began to explain the eviction process, and it really is a process, right? Can you walk us through what those proceedings look like?
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, I think I'd like to start with reiterating that it is a process that a landlord has to go through to remove someone, to remove a tenant from a property. If a tenant's in a position where the landlord has not gone through the eviction process in court, that's what we call a self-help eviction, and that is illegal. It's not allowed. And that is something we saw. So that is something I wanted to make sure people understood, is that that is not something that's appropriate. So, for example, we saw some clients who had their power and water turned off during the eviction moratorium in lieu of an eviction case being filed. And the appropriate action there is to call the police, call the sheriff's office to help restore you to your property, restore you to those services until the process can take place. So I just wanted to mention that at the outset, because I think that's a very important thing for people to know. It hopefully doesn't happen too often, but, you know, it is something that needs to be addressed. As far as the process goes, you know, the eviction is, by definition, the court process. And after getting a notice, like I mentioned earlier, a landlord is entitled to file an eviction action to have a tenant removed from their property, removed with the assistance, essentially, of the sheriff's office. The notice that they get, it changes depending on the type of tenancy and depending on the reason for why the eviction is happening. So, for example, a tenant who's behind on rent will typically get a five-day notice saying that they have 5 days to either pay rent or to move out of the property in order to avoid the eviction filing.
There's an opportunity. It doesn't necessarily mean that you've lost your home. It means this is your final opportunity to make a decision which way you have to go.
Exactly, yeah. And that five-day cure period is really critical, because if you cure the issue, if you remedy the problem by paying rent or by moving, that stops a landlord from being able to file the eviction and stops CCAP from having the record of that eviction action against you, which, as we've seen, as we've heard so many times, is a problem for renters as they try to find new housing.
And there are many rights that tenants do have. Also, landlords, you know, follow certain rules and have rights of their own. Where should we go to find that information? I mean, certainly we'll continue talking with you about it now, but is there a place we should go to look for that?
Sure. Well, you know, so being a lawyer, the statutes, the regulations obviously have the definitive explanation of rights and responsibilities. That's obviously going to be a little dense for a lot of people, but there are other resources that are available. There are in Milwaukee, there's a newly created rental housing resource center. It's basically a collaboration between tenant advocates like Legal Action, as well as landlord groups and community service groups like community advocates, where they have resources to help people deal with landlord-tenant related issues on both sides of the equation.
All right. We'll keep talking about it here. Our conversation with Rafael Ramos continues as we talk about evictions here in Wisconsin, tenant rights, landlord rights, what the law really says. We're taking your questions at 800-642-1234. You're listening to this conversation on The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Eviction is a scary word for most people, and it's a real possibility for people who can't pay their rent. That's true as record numbers of people in our state have lost work and are trying to figure out how to make money to support their families. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show with attorney Rafael Ramos. I'm Keely Boltina, and there's room for you in this discussion. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Are you facing eviction? Are you worried that you might not be able to pay rent next month and you're wondering what your options are? What questions do you have about renting and tenants' rights here in Wisconsin? 800-642-1234, that number again. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Rafael, depending on where you live, there could be some room in between paying your rent fully, on time, all the time, and being evicted. What options do people have at any point during the court process, even ahead of missing that first payment?
Sure. Well, I think one thing that people should know is, you know, one of the main issues that people end up being evicted, either pre-COVID or not, is basically a failure to communicate with the landlord. And right now, especially when so many people are unable to make payments, I think it's really important for people to try to talk if they can, if the relationship allows for it, especially now because there are a lot of resources that are available that didn't exist pre-COVID-19. You know, for example, if a tenant is trying to pursue Wisconsin rent assistance payments, that money can help them make up what they owe. And if they're able to communicate with the landlord and work together to figure out an opportune time to make those payments, hopefully you can avoid the actual eviction filing and the entire court process entirely by working something out between parties. So that's kind of where I think people should try to start, because unfortunately the laws really are what they are. And if you fall behind on rent, if you don't make a payment within that cure period that we discussed, then you are at risk of eviction. And the only real way to avoid that is to work together to try to resolve the issue.
We've got Joe from Madison ready to talk with us. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. I had a question. I know we're talking about Wisconsin. I'm from here in Madison, but my mom this weekend called me saying that she's behind $244 in rent because her landlord, knowing that she was getting a stimulus check, or pretty much everybody in the apartment complex was getting a stimulus check, they raised the rent. she used the stimulus check for other bills that she was behind on and medications that she hadn't been able to get. She was able to get this time with a stimulus check and fix her vehicle. But I was wondering, like, is that fair? Should there be a place that I can help guide her to find out if this was fair? I mean, I know she's in Texas, but I just feel like that was unfair for them to raise the rent just because they knew she was getting a stimulus check.
Yeah, Joe, thanks.
I think my answer off the air. Thanks.
Certainly. Joe, thanks for that question. And Rafael, the difference between fair and legal might be pretty significant in some of these cases. What about Joe's mom's circumstance?
Yeah, I think it's an important distinction to make. You know, unfortunately, there is a difference between what is fair and what is legal. And I obviously can't opine as to what the specific situation is down in Texas. But here in Wisconsin, there's no prohibition against landlords raising rents right now due to COVID, you know, during COVID-19 and the health crisis. There are prohibitions against them imposing late fees for payments, but theoretically, they could legally raise rent, legally. But there is a question of whether that's appropriate or fair at this time, and regrettably, there's not a lot that anyone can do from the legal side of things to stop someone from doing that. But if people are using stimulus checks to make payments, and those payments are late, one thing that we would definitely recommend is that people try to make sure to document that agreement to try to protect themselves and insulate themselves from a future potential suit, so that if the payment's late, they at least have some sort of proof that that was part of an agreement between parties. But yeah, as far as raising rent goes, it's unfortunate, and it's particularly brutal right now, but it's not illegal, at least not in Wisconsin. You know, in Texas, they should look because each state has taken a different approach. But here, that's something that landlords are allowed to do.
So search around for advocates in Texas to see maybe if Joe can find out some more information.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, okay. I think one thing to know is that there are landlords who are doing things like that that are morally questionable. But there are also a lot of landlords who are deferring eviction actions at this time. And that's important to remember, too. And that's one of the reasons why I urged communication earlier, because you never know who you're working with, and avoiding eviction is something that really will take a communal response right now.
Yeah, we're talking with Rafael Ramos, who's an attorney with Legal Action of Wisconsin, serves as the coordinator for the Eviction Defense Project. And we had Sylvester call in. They were wondering, you know, if someone has a newborn baby, would a landlord take that into account? I mean, our family circumstances considered, and you're saying some landlords will.
Yeah, it's always case by case. Again, legally, having a newborn baby does not entitle anyone to any additional protections under the law. It does, as a lot of people know, and potentially entitle you to additional resources. You know, for example, CARES Act stimulus money, additional children should give someone access to more financial support. But it doesn't insulate or protect you from an eviction. So, you know, working through that situation is important. And then if you can't, reaching out to resources like Legal Action or other community service organizations to try to find what assistance you can and what other opportunities may exist.
Greg from Milwaukee has given us a call now, has a question. Hi, Greg.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. What's on your mind?
Okay, I was wondering, there's sometimes remedies in 401ks, my particular plan has a remedy for hardship to avoid eviction. And what I'm wondering is, do you have to be in the actual process? Does it have to be filed by the landlord before you can access those funds? Or is that dependent upon the particular fund manager?
Thanks for the question, Greg. Rafael, any idea about that?
That's a really good point, actually. That's not something that we hear a lot of. That is something that I would suggest that you speak directly to your fund manager about. You know, I'm not familiar with the specifics of Greg's 401k, but there are different resources available that, you know, public resources, rent assistance, emergency assistance, that requires a showing that the eviction is imminent, if not already in process. So if, you know, one thing that may be worth showing the 401k fund manager is if you've received a notice terminating tenancy, which is essentially the immediate precursor to filing, you know, that might be sufficient to show that the threat of eviction is real and that they need access to those funds. You know, otherwise communication indicating that the eviction is on its way might be able to convince someone, but again, unfortunately, because it's going to be specific to that 401k, I think you need to work with the different fund managers that you have. But that's a great idea to go to that as a resource.
Yeah, not state law, Greg. So maybe that's an option for you to look into for sure. Rafael, your offices, the Legal Action of Wisconsin's physical offices are closed. We've seen courts have to pivot during even regardless of the hearings, but including eviction hearings. So what have courts done in Wisconsin to make those hearings accessible to tenants?
So the courts are in a very difficult spot right now. Obviously, we're trying to maintain social distancing, trying to keep the coronavirus at bay. And to do that, the court has largely moved to remote hearings, using Zoom or teleconferencing is the primary means through which the small claims court, which is what handles evictions in Milwaukee, is handling those hearings. So people really need to be on the lookout in the mail for notices from the court, because the notice will contain the information you need to participate in that hearing. And that's particularly true if people have moved. They really need to update the court to let them know where they are so that they can get that notice. Because the same as it was with physical appearances, if you do not show up for your hearing, even virtually, there is a very, very high likelihood that the court will have to enter what's called a default judgment, where they essentially grant the eviction because the tenant, the defendant, didn't appear. And that's really the biggest concern that we have as advocates is this process fair right now? And the court is doing what it can, but you know, there's no physical courthouse to go to at the moment.
Rafael, thank you for joining us this morning.
No, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for talking about these important issues.
Rafael Ramos is an attorney with Legal Action of Wisconsin, where he serves as the coordinator for Legal Action's Eviction Defense Project. We've been talking about options for tenants who can't pay their rent and how evictions work in Wisconsin. We've also posted links to the resources we mentioned online at WPR.org/mornings. Up next is news. I'm Keely Boltina. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. The stock market has seen incredible swings during the pandemic as investors lose and gain confidence. Yet CNBC notes big tech stocks have fared better than most. As people suddenly working from home rely more on online services, Amazon stock rose more than 3% just yesterday. Amazon, that's the company we're talking about this morning, the same one with a few thousand workers in its Kenosha Fulfillment Center here in Wisconsin. And we're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. How much do you know about Amazon? It's one of the world's largest companies and retailers. How has Amazon changed the way you shop? Do you use it or do you opt out? 1-800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. James Ball is the global editor of the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. He oversees the not-for-profit's international reporting projects. He wrote the United States of Amazon series for digital news outlet called Tortoise Media. James, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning. Your recent reporting is focusing on Amazon. There are so many large tech companies that affect our lives. Why focus on Amazon?
I think the effect of Amazon is kind of even more obvious than something like Google or Facebook, where at least they kind of stay in our phones or on our computer screens. You can be sort of browsing Amazon on your computer, using internet services that it's provided with a whole secret business it's got behind the scenes on an Amazon Kindle device. You might then ask a question to an AI made by Amazon, Alexa, and then you may sort of get a delivery at your door of all the goods. It's the logistics operation. It's got sort of indirectly about 4 million jobs reliant on Amazon. It is this huge physical sort of entity in our world, as well as this sort of tech company. And so it really brings together the online and the offline kind of worlds in a way that most tech companies don't.
Yeah, because you have the physical, you can look out the window and see other people with Amazon boxes, or they might be sitting on your counter while you're using your phone. We know Amazon as that website. You can order just about anything. And there's something that strikes us that you've written. So we're going to use your words. You write, to be able to click a button and see almost any product appear on your doorstep within 24 hours feels less like commerce and more like magic. What do you want people to realize about that?
I think it's that this doesn't come without a price. You know, we shouldn't sort of turn Amazon into a sort of, you know, cartoon bad guy. It is pretty great that we have access to all of this stuff, especially if we don't live somewhere where we have a bunch of stores on our doorstep. But it now means that every mom and pop store in every small town is competing directly with this global giant, which is quite ruthlessly focused on efficiency. You know, they want to get stuff to you as quickly as they can, as cheaply as they can, and they cut out any sort of waste. They sort of make everything run as quickly as possible. And that comes at a cost for the workers. You know, their warehouses are so automated and so sort of regimented, that you do hear reports of sort of people working in really, really tricky conditions and feeling really pressured, you know, not even to take restroom breaks. And does those effects, we sort of have to make sure we don't keep invisible. It's really easy for us to see the good side. You click something and 48 hours later it arrives on your doorstep. It's great. It's magic. But that's been done by actually quite a lot of people working very hard, and also maybe at the cost of other businesses and other communities that we wouldn't want to lose.
Certainly, we talk about brick and mortar stores shutting down, but I mean, Amazon in its beginning was not a find all be all place. They really focused, I mean, I remember, on books.
It's kind of wild to think about it now. If you go back to 1997, this was Amazon's kind of first annual report to its shareholders. It had just listed. And it boasted that it had 200,000 books on offer now, and how huge a range that would be, and that it now needed to a really big warehouse to store them. And how quaint does that sound now? Like, how cozy. And I think the thing we can miss with Amazon is they always had this huge ambition. And they used books because that was an easy first product. It's sort of quite easy to store. It sort of doesn't go out of date. You know, it's not going to rot in your warehouse. And so, you know, you could work out the kinks in the system with that and then expand your range. But what we miss about Amazon now is even the bit of it that's most obvious, the website that we go on and shop, it's not really a store. Something like half of what you buy on there is sold by someone else. It's not sold by Amazon. And so it's a little bit like if someone like Walmart let in all the mom and pop shops from the high street and kind of went, actually, you can carry on, but we want to take a cut of what you're doing and you'll sit inside our big shed. And so quite quietly, it's turned into this sort of logistics platform for the world. I mean, you know, I don't know how much they're doing in America. They're doing some of this, but in the UK, they're delivering coronavirus tests and they're right in all the logistics of the crisis.
Yeah. And there are some places where, you know, Amazon has same day delivery. You can order your groceries through Amazon. They've partnered with places like Whole Foods. So it's a really expansive operation. So we're going to talk more about some of the challenges you found with Amazon, but people have benefited from Amazon's rapid growth. That's real. That's true.
I mean, for one thing, it's one of the best stocks that you could have bought over the last 20 years. You know, they have really returned for shareholders. They are worth more than $1 trillion now. They are likely to be worth $2 trillion in the next few years. That's benefited a lot of their employees. It's benefited a lot of other places. It's sort of known as a good place to work if you fit the culture, if you work in the actual headquarters, if you're a programmer or you're helping sort of deliver sort of some of its other stuff as a more senior role. It's got quite a ruthless culture in some ways. They want you to be critical. They want you to be honest, but it gives you a lot of power to make decisions. They pay well. So it's created a lot of good paying jobs, and not necessarily where other tech companies have. They're not in Silicon Valley like almost all of their rivals. So for some people, it's good jobs. For some people, it's good shareholder return. And the sort of distinguishing, almost scary thing about Amazon is its sort of ruthless focus on the customer. You know, Apple have got really, really fancy offices. You know, they've got sort of 40-foot high sort of plate glass doors that open with this custom one-in-the-world mechanism, all of this stuff. You go to Amazon, your desk is still made out of a cheap old door, and they still use chain link fence and all of this to kind of go, the money goes on the operations, the money goes on delivering for the customer. And this kind of really relentless focus comes from Jeff Bezos. And it does mean they deliver fast, they deliver reliably, and they deliver cheaply. And that does benefit a lot of customers. They are a well-managed business for what they do. And the question is, what are the side effects of what they do? And is that something that Amazon and Amazon's managers should worry about? Or is that something that the people who regulate them or make the laws should worry about?
James Ball is an investigative journalist who's exploring how the company Amazon has changed our economy and our society. Taking your calls at 800-642-1234. You can also send us your questions via email. Just type in ideas@WPR.org. James, Amazon has played an important role in helping millions of people get these essential goods during the pandemic. There have also been coronavirus outbreaks at their warehouses, including in Kenosha here in Wisconsin. I mean, employees working shoulder to shoulder, warehouses running full speed ahead. What has that meant for Amazon's employees during this pandemic?
I think this is where we really start to get into the concerning parts about Amazon. The company insists that they've tried to take lots of extra precautions. They've put safety first. They've paid attention to all of this. But that's not what everyone who works there says. And what's sort of been quite concerning is, you know, a lot of the warehouse workers at Amazon are very casualized jobs. They're not union jobs. They don't have much security. And they're often quite worried to speak out if you need the paycheck. And no one wants to be without benefits during a pandemic, if you have them. But you have this sort of issue that people have said in reality, the conditions weren't living up to what management said. They were too close. There were outbreaks in warehouses, as you said. And some staff even sort of up the food chain tried to actually raise the alarm about this and kind of just got denials or got stonewalled. And so in the piece that we did for Tortoise, I spoke to a very, very senior exec who had quit Amazon because about four or five of the managers who said, we are really worried about our staff safety and our warehouse's safety and we need to do more. They got fired for speaking out on that. And for this sort of senior exec who Amazon is graded level 1 to level 12, Jeff Bezos is level 12. If you just come and start working in a warehouse, you're level 1. This guy was level 10. He was called Tim Bray. And he quit his job and probably walked away from $1 million or so in compensation because Amazon was firing people who were trying to say, you're not doing enough to keep your workers safe during coronavirus. And, you know, I think a lot of us want Amazon to keep working through Corona. For some people, it's how they get their groceries or it's how they're getting stuff to keep their home running, especially if you're vulnerable and you can't go out. But we shouldn't sort of lose sight of the fact they don't seem to be doing everything they can to keep it safe, despite all of their assurances.
We're talking with investigative journalist James Ball, whose reporting focuses on the influence that tech companies have on our lives, and that includes massive online retailer Amazon. Room for your calls at 800-642-1234. What effect do you think Amazon is having on our economy, on workers, on our society? Ideas@WPR.org is the email address you can use, or you can pick up the phone, 800-642-1234. I'm Keely Boltina. We're having this conversation on The Morning Show. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking with investigative journalist James Ball. He's written a series called The United States of Amazon. He reports that Amazon collected $33 million in sales every hour of every day for the first 3 months of this year. And as we have this conversation, we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you think you know about Amazon, one of the world's largest companies and retailers? How has Amazon changed the way you shop? 800-642-1234. And we've got a caller on the line now. Steve from Sun Prairie is thinking about this combination. Good morning, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
You know, I don't want to date myself here, but I remember watching the great Dr. Milton Friedman on a Phil Donahue episode, probably in the late 70s, early 80s. And Phil Donahue was lamenting how big Kmart was getting and how Kmart was knocking all the mom and pop businesses out. And he said, what's going to happen if Sears buys Kmart, they'll rule the world? Well, we all know what happened. Sears bought Kmart, and they're both bankrupt. So there will be other companies that come and take market share away from Amazon when Amazon loses its ability to meet with the client, the customer's expectations are. That's just the history of capitalism.
Steve, thanks for that line of thinking. And James, what do you think about Steve's comment? Can someone just replace Amazon? Is it different?
It's Steve makes a really good point. And actually, I think Jeff Bezos would agree with him. Bezos is kind of an interesting CEO. Some tech CEOs start to think of themselves as like quite strange, sort of evangelical. You know, the CEO of We, which used to be called WeWork, talked about building a company that would last 1,000 years, that his children and grandchildren would take over as if it's an ancient empire. Bezos says companies come and companies go. He expects Amazon to decline and to die, but he wants that to happen long after he dies, which is pretty understandable. And so he talks about day one companies and day two. And he says day one companies are trying to grow. They're seeing it as the start of something. They're being very sort of relentlessly focused on expansion, on doing more, doing what they can. And he says the second you become a day two company, it's the beginning of the end. It might take a long time, but essentially you're on managed decline. You're sort of heading towards the exit. And so, yes, Amazon won't be forever, but it intends to be around for quite a long time. And so is it about saying this company's got to take over the world and we'll never be able to handle it, like some people got overexcited on for Sears, for Kmart, for Walmart, you name it? No, it won't be forever. But how do we make sure while it's here, it's working in all of our interests and it's not sort of sucking the life out of the economy too much or taking too big a cost on workers or on society? And maybe we think the balance is just about right where it is. But I think we should at least ask ourselves the question on, is it? Because quite a few people who used to work there, there's even some analysts, will say it's a well-managed, very successful, very focused company, but it's focused on its customers, on its shareholders. Someone needs to look at the wider implications of it.
Talking with James Ball, who's an investigative journalist. His new series looks at the power and influence tech companies wield on our lives, focusing on Amazon today. And James, when you talk about that, making Amazon work while it's around, if it's not too big to fail, it is such a huge part of our economy. Sounds like you're talking regulation.
I think we probably are talking regulation. I think some people would probably like to see Amazon shut down tomorrow, but that would put hundreds of thousands of people out of work and actually deny a lot of people services they like. You know, it isn't just a store. A lot of the web runs on Amazon servers. That's a $40 billion a year business in revenue. You know, they've got our streaming services. They've got Audible. You probably sort of use Amazon services that you don't even know about. What we need to sort of look at is, are we doing enough to cover workers in an environment where Amazon's there? You know, is there a way to find unions that work for much more casual workforces? Should we have more protections in there to sort of look out for them? Are there things we could do to try and make sure that we feel like we're getting a fair amount of tax from companies like Amazon? A lot of brick and mortar stores sort of complain that they have to pay local taxes and Amazon doesn't. And so, of course, it can undercut them. Are there ways we can level the playing field? And if you're not American, and you can guess from my accent, I'm not, Britain gets no tax revenue from everything it sells with Amazon. We get some sales tax, but nothing from the profits. Should it be the case that if this company's sort of become one of our biggest retailers, should it not pay a bit of tax in each company it operates? That's kind of the questions for regulators. I think if they're looking at how do we bring it down for its own sake, that's kind of anti-competitive, that's anti-business, that's not going to help. But can we make sure it's benefiting everyone and not just a tiny group of owners? I think that's exactly what regulators and lawmakers should be looking at.
You mentioned taxes. What kind of taxes does Amazon actually pay?
So Amazon still actually doesn't make nearly as much profit as it could, which helps reduce it a lot. The main sort of things that Amazon pays is, depending where it locates, it does have to pay some local sales taxes and some taxes in countries. But like other multinationals, it's faced quite a lot of criticism for setting up quite elaborate structures that minimize how much corporation tax it pays. And obviously, that mainly affects the US and the US shareholders. Now, all of that's legal, and it's in line with a lot of other companies doing it. But some of the questions for countries around the world is, you know, we used to have UK-based retailers, or France had French retailers that would sell in the country and pay corporation tax and sort of feed through the system. One question that is being asked a lot in Europe is, hey, if Amazon makes, say, a third of its sales here, shouldn't it be paying about a third of its corporation tax here? Now, that's got to get a bit contentious all across the world. And so you might need lawmakers in the US and around the world to go, what's fair for these big companies? How much tax do we think they should be paying? How do we think they should pay it? And I think the risk is that all the regulators end up arguing with each other so much that Amazon and other tech giants can carry on pretty much not paying very much to anyone because we all try and wait to sort this out perfectly first.
You're saying Amazon is a global company, so you need a global approach if you expect to be able to set regulations or standards.
Yeah, there are things that countries can do on their own, and especially when it comes to looking after your workers or checking your conditions or making sure competition's fair. But there are limits to what you can do as one country. Even if you're a country as big as the US, which is sort of unusual now, but the EU overall is a bigger market than the US. It's bigger and it's richer if you count all 27 countries in it. My country is not in it anymore. But that means that it has to be taken very seriously. You've, of course, got growing markets in China and India across the world. And so one country can do a little bit, and if they have the will to do it, they should. But if everyone just focuses on their own thing, they kind of get a bit stuck because these are global companies and they can move jobs, they can move data, they can move warehouses and operations a lot more easily than they could 20 or 30 years ago.
James, thank you for breaking down your reporting for us and helping us better understand how Amazon affects us in ways we might not even realize. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
James Ball is the global editor of the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. He oversees the not-for-profit's international reporting projects, and he wrote the United States of Amazon series for a digital news outlet called Tortoise Media. His new book is called The System, Who Owns the Internet and How It Owns Us, and it comes out in August. Just ahead, we're talking with four teachers from across the state. We're hearing how they handled sudden distance learning, how they're wrapping up this school year, and what comes next. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.